Welcome to the Trinity Heights Church podcast. I'm Stephen Chern, and we are a community of Christians and skeptics exploring the biblical narrative together. Well, we are in the... Well, good morning, first of all, and welcome to my father-in-law, Brian, who's sitting at the back there. Nice to have you here this last week. So we are in the seventh part of our series, The Prophetic Imagination. And you'll notice that when Jesus gets into these very intense confrontations with people, there's this phrase, this question that he uses, and you'll be familiar with it. He says, have you not read? Have you not read that God has ordained that praise will come out of the lips of these infants and children? Have you not read what David and his men did when they were hungry and went into the temple? Have you not read that the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone today? Have you not read that God has told you that I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the God of the living and not the dead? Have you not read? Have you not read? At some point, I used to think that this was a little bit of a strange question to ask. Because think of it this way. Think about it. It's estimated that 90% of people in Israel at the time, under the Roman Empire, during Jesus' day and then for the couple of centuries after Jesus' day, right? It's estimated that 90% of people were able to write their name or otherwise not even be able to do that. And that was it. So literacy rates, they think, were somewhere between 3 to 8% at the tops. It's hard to get an accurate read on these numbers. So let's be really generous and double that, right? That double that top end. Let's say it was 16%. 16% literacy. So look, when Jesus asks this question, as many times as he does, have you not read, have you not read? The answer is, of course they haven't read it, because they're a bunch of illiterate peasants who can't write their own name, let alone read and write. What are you saying? Unless, of course, when he gets into these intense, sharp confrontations, he's not talking to the illiterate peasants, but he's talking to the very literate Pharisees and the very well-educated Sadducees and the oh-so-cultured and sophisticated Herodians. And as it turns out, when you look at it, you look up each one of them, you can do this yourself, look up each time he says, have you not read, have you not read, have you not read? He's always talking to those people. In other words, Jesus is, these in most intense conversations take place with the educated, cultured class. This isn't just peculiar to Jesus. Actually, there are other people who have been recognized as prophetic voices in their own right, in their own way. Some voices perhaps a little closer to home, who you'll find this sort of common theme with. I'm thinking of a couple of my favorite authors, George Orwell. Right? Love his books, you know that. And Friedrich Nietzsche, of course. So that's the second time he's been mentioned, but not by me. Well, I've only mentioned him once. He said, do we have separate Nietzsche counters? How are we doing this now? Right, you mentioned him once, I mentioned him once. Okay, so we've got both of them. If you read those guys, you will find that they are absolutely scathing of the educated culture class. So look, I'm bringing this up again for the second time in this series, for 7 weeks, second time in this series, because it is just the most natural thing in the world. It's almost just knee-jerk, reflexive kind of thing to sort of bat away any prophetic critique and send it off in some other direction and say, well, it's about those people over there. So I'm underlining this thing that we see very clearly in Jesus' ministry, because I want us to recognize that Jesus' most intense confrontations take place with people like us. And this sort of self-reflection, this ability to reflect collectively, this self-critique, or perhaps the way we should say it is this, this ability to critique the collective to which we belong, this ability to critique the collective to which you and I belong is absolutely fundamental to being able to cultivate the prophetic imagination. Absolutely crucial. So as you're reading through the New Testament, keep that in the back of your mind. Tell you something else that I've noticed, which is also a little strange. When you read Jesus' words, and something else that happens when you read George Orwell or you read Friedrich Nietzsche, you wouldn't think these people had much in common, but actually they've got a lot in common. And something else they have in common is when you read them, you start to ask yourself, and this happens to me a lot when I'm just have to put the book down and go, what is happening here? I often ask myself, how on earth did they know that things were going to turn out this way? How did they see this coming? How did they know that this is the way things were going to happen? Decades, century in advance. How do they know this? Did they have a crystal ball? You know, did they time travel? What's going on here? So I'll give you an example of the sort of thing that I'm talking about. This is Nietzsche writing in 1881. And what he's doing is he's reflecting on the fate of the Jewish people in the next century. So there he is, the 19th century, and he's reflecting on the fate of the Jewish people in the 20th century, as you do, you know. And he says this of the people of Israel: among the spectacles to which the coming century invites us is the decision as to the destiny of the Jews of Europe. That their die is cast, that they have crossed their Rubicon, is now palpably obvious. All that is left for them is either to become the masters of Europe or to lose Europe as they once a long time ago lost Egypt, where they placed themselves before a similar either or. At the time, I would have said, oh, you're being so dramatic. You know, this isn't going to happen. Actually, if you knew what was happening, if anyone came up with sort of the slightest bit of anti-Semitic rhetoric, you know, in high up positions, they were gone. I can give you examples from the particular year 1873, and that set established the norm, that set the trend. But it's a similar thing to when Jesus was also, like Nietzsche, talking about the fate of Israel. And he looks at the temple, and there's this massive temple complex, and he points to these beautiful buildings that Herod had built, and he says, not one stone is going to be left on another. This whole place is going to be turned into rubble. In fact, Jerusalem is going to be an extension of Gehenna. Gehenna was the rubbish pit where they burned all the trash. Usually when you read things and it says hell, they're talking about Gehenna, the place where all the trash was burned outside the city. And he's saying, look, Gehenna is just going to extend into Jerusalem. Jerusalem is going to be reduced to rubble. And people scoffed. Everyone scoffed. And I like to think that if I'd been around at Jesus' time, I would not have scoffed, but I would have scoffed. Okay, I would have done, right? This is another thing. When you're reading the Bible, try not to over-identify with Jesus too much. I think this is what we do too much. You know, oh yeah, I'm on his side. No. This is not how that works. I would have been scoffing. But AD 70 comes around and the temple is destroyed. And AD 120 comes around and Israel is sent off into exile. You know, it's very typical response to this is to say, oh, don't you know that this was written after the fact? This was written after AD 70, after AD 120. This was just retrofitted with prophecy. It looks like prophecy, but it's really just history. It's just telling you what's already passed. This is often the response of the very well-educated. I'll tell you what I think. I think that when we say this sort of thing, what we're really showing is how little prophetic imagination we've been able to cultivate in ourselves. The fact that we can't even understand and can't even imagine how they could have, Jesus couldn't possibly have predicted this. It just goes to show how little prophetic imagination we've been able to cultivate in ourselves. As we press in to read Jesus' words more closely, and the same with these other prophetic voices, you read Orwell a little more closely, you read Nietzsche a little more closely and carefully, what you discover, you start to get a sense of how they did this. You see, people like Orwell and Nietzsche and Jesus had a much deeper understanding of their own day and their own place. They had a much more intimate knowledge of their contemporary situation than anyone else around them. Never mind about the future, okay? Don't worry about it. Put the future out of your head for the minute. They had a much more intimate knowledge of their own contemporary situation than anyone else around them. They knew how things were actually going down, regardless of how they said things were going down. They knew how things were actually going down. And this gave them the ability to extrapolate out decades, even centuries in advance. And that gave them this incredible predictive power. They could see tomorrow because they could see today so crystal clearly. But in some ways, that's just as mysterious, isn't it? We replace one mystery with another mystery. Why do these people see things so clearly? What's so special about them? Why are they able to understand what's going on and no one else around them, the educated cultural class, they can't see it? There are other people who are just as educated and just as intelligent as they were. What gives? What's going on? That's a question which I'm just going to begin to answer, right? And actually, I'm going to save a lot of the answer for next week, okay? So we'll carry this question over a couple of weeks. There's a multi-layered answer to this question. I mean, we'll just start. So to begin to answer this question, I want to sort of zoom in on one of those have you not read sayings, okay? So let's just zoom in on one of them, just one of them. That same day, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him with a question. Teacher, they said, Moses told us that if a man dies without having children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up offspring for him. Now there were seven brothers among us. The first one married and died, and since he had no children, he left his wife to his brother. The same thing happened to the second and third brother, right on down to the seventh. Finally, the woman died. Now then, at the resurrection, whose wife will she be of the seven, since all of them were married to her? Jesus answers the question, explaining, at the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. There's going to be this different physical, bodily type of existence and a different social existence. A new creation, the resurrection, it's going to be different. So you can't apply necessarily the rules of the original creation to the new creation as it will stand. So Jesus answers a question and then wanders off. No. Jesus doesn't leave it there. Because Jesus knows that that's not really the question they're asking. The question they're asking is not actually a religious question about what happens when I die. It's not even a question about this interesting sociological conundrum. Whose wife and husband are whose spouse is whose? That's not what he's asking. They're not asking a sociological question or a religious question. What they're asking is a political question. Not that they would have divided those things up in that way anyway, but let's just go with that, right? We work with those divisions. They're asking a political question. And here's why. Matthew says that same day. What same day? Well, the same day as they had just come to him earlier. It was the Pharisees and Herodians, which is an odd mashup. Those two never hang out. But suddenly they can team up to try and trap Jesus into saying something political about paying taxes to Caesar. Here's his question about the emperor and your taxes, and we're going to get you to say something political, and we're going to get you. And so this is that same day, Matthew says. And so it's the same day they came to him with this question. And so this is a continuation of that sort of political entrapment. If Matthew had you and I in mind, I was thinking of a congregation in New York City in the 21st century, he could have actually given us a little footnote here, or he could have had this nice preamble to this section, this discussion, right? And the preamble, I've just imagined what the preamble would have been. So I'm just filling in for Matthew here. I think this is what was in the back of his mind. So here's how the preamble would have gone to this conversation. The resurrection is at odds with the imperial imagination, because the resurrection declares an approaching end to the status quo and the beginning of something entirely new here on earth, whereas the imperial imagination only wants to narrate its own eternity. Therefore, the Sadducees, who ran Israel's most important institutions such as the temple and the Sanhedrin, and who were in bed with Herod, who was in bed with Rome, had no interest in ending the status quo, and so those people said there is no resurrection. I think that's the kind of preamble that would have been helpful for people like us, but he doesn't say that. He just sort of assumes it, and he says the Sadducees, who said there is no resurrection, came to him. And what Jesus does is interesting. He sort of brushes past the initial question, right? The pretend question, if you like, and he gets hold of the real question. And he says, but about the resurrection of the dead, because that's what you're really asking about, isn't it? This is what makes you uneasy. But about the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what God said to you? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And so what Jesus is doing is he's addressing the self-appointed guardians of Israel. And through these confrontations, he's showing them that they are actually at odds with their own scriptures. Something's gone wrong with the way they're using language. They're using the language of the scriptures. They've co-opted the language of the scriptures, but they're using them and to tell the story in this weird way that actually pushes God out of the story altogether and allows them to seize control, assert their dominance, and maintain their power. And so whenever Jesus asks this question, have you not read, followed by the retrieval of some passage of scripture, this is Jesus' way of exposing their self-serving language, their self-serving narration of their own reality. I'm going to end here with a quote from George Orwell. It describes, I think, the situation not just in his day, but I think what was going on with Jesus. And as I read this quote and comment on it, just think of how it might connect with our own situation as well. It's from an article published in April 1946, so a year after the World War II ended. It's called Politics in the English Language, and he says this: the present political chaos is connected with the decay of language. But one can probably bring about some improvement by starting at the verbal end. This is where Jesus begins, right? He starts at the verbal end. Have you not read? Is something gone wrong with the way that you are using this language? Have you not read? Orwell says, now it's clear that the decline of language must ultimately have political and economic causes. Yes, the Sadducees don't want things upset, right? We stay like this. But an effect can become a cause, reinforcing the original cause and producing the same effect in an intensified form. A man may take to drink because he feels himself to be a failure and then fail all the more completely because he drinks. It's rather the same thing that is happening to the English language. It becomes ugly and inaccurate because our thoughts are foolish. But the slovenliness of our language makes it easier for us to have foolish thoughts. The political dialects vary from party to party, but they're all alike in that one almost never finds in them a fresh, vivid, homemade turn of speech. When one watches some tired hack on the platform mechanically repeating the familiar phrases, one often has a curious feeling that one is not watching a live human being, but some kind of dummy. A feeling which suddenly becomes stronger at moments when the light catches the speaker's spectacles and turns them into blank discs, which seem to have no eyes behind them. Hopefully that's not my house. I'll just do this and then... And this is not altogether fanciful, he says. A speaker who uses that kind of phraseology has gone some distance toward turning himself into a machine. The appropriate noises are coming out of his larynx, but he is not engaged as he would be if he were choosing his words for himself. He may be almost unconscious of what he is saying. And this reduced state of consciousness, if not indispensable, is at any rate favorable to political conformity. The Sadducees were a people no longer choosing their words for themselves, but were using a language that had been given to them by their political context. And they started to use that language to reinforce that context. So when Jesus asks, "Have you not read?" what he's doing is he's saying, look, I want to reconnect you with your own past, with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and I want to reconnect you with your God, the God of the living and not the dead, and the God who can offer you a different future.
The Trinity Heights Church podcast is recorded right here in New York City. If you happen to be in the city, then feel free to join us in person. You can get more information about our service times through trinityheightschurch.com. Also, if you feel compelled to contribute to the ongoing ministry of Trinity Heights Church, then go to our giving page. Thanks for listening.